For nearly an entire school year, college campuses across the U.S. have been consumed by the war in Gaza and allegations of anti-Semitism. Protests first broke out shortly after the October 7th attack, in which Hamas terrorists killed 1,200 Israelis and took another 250 hostage. The Israeli government responded with a military campaign that has killed 34,000 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. But over the last few days, the protests surrounding this war and the responses from university leaders to those protests have significantly ramped up.
Police in riot gear detained protesters at Columbia University, loading them into multiple buses as they cleared out students who had camped out in tents on the school's south lawn.
From New York University, you can actually see police in riot gear here, dismantling the encampment, arresting multiple people.
This morning, police say at least 45 pro-Palestinian protesters were arrested at Yale University for violating Yale's policies and instructions.
So you yourself were also threatened with arrest, right? Just because you and other reporters were there trying to cover what was happening?
Yeah, my Monday morning was a lot. This group of, I want to say like 4 to 6-ish cops comes to this part of the wall that we're on and is like, you guys have to get on the off the wall or we're going to arrest you.
Anika Arora Seth is the editor-in-chief and president of the Yale Daily News. She was on the scene first thing Monday morning when Yale police arrested 47 protesters for trespassing during a demonstration in support of Palestinians. I called Anika to ask what it's been like for her as a student journalist covering these protests on the ground and to try to understand why this era of campus activism feels so incredibly fraught. You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. Hey, Anika, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I just wanted to start by kind of checking in with you and how you are doing and how the rest of the Yale Daily News is doing. I can only imagine how hard it must be trying to cover something like this while also going to class and trying to have relationships with the peers who you're reporting on.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess off the bat, I'll say at least for me and a couple of our lead editors, there's not a lot of going to class happening right now. So there's that. But I think, you know, on October 7th, when Hamas first attacked Israel, I will be honest that I don't really think I understood, as probably most people didn't, what a strong ripple effect this would have on American campuses. Obviously, it was tragic and would have tremendous geopolitical ramifications in the Middle East. But I don't think I realized how much this would consume our newsroom. I remember that first week of covering vigils and protests. It was a lot of learning that we had to do incredibly quickly, right? And in Yale College, we have like our October recess, like kind of that middle of October-ish. So that week was really just like running and trying to get to this like brief reprieve with which you could like retabulate and figure out a plan for the rest of the semester and year. But I think as soon as that first doxing truck was at Columbia and at Harvard, that's when we were like, okay, this is going to get very intense here very quickly.
Can you explain what the doxing truck is?
The doxing truck was run by this company called like Accuracy in Media that would plaster students' faces and names on the sides of this truck. It was like, you know, a truck that had three sides of like a digitally emblazoned kind of electronic billboard. It wasn't always super clear where these names and faces were being pulled from, but it seems as though they were being pulled from various statements that students would have signed in support of a ceasefire or condemning the Israeli military response to Hamas's attack on Israel.
So this was all early days, right?
I think it was mostly like that second week after October 7th in the other parts of the Northeast. That truck didn't come to Yale until right before Thanksgiving break in November for the Harvard-Yale football game. It's like the biggest athletic event in the Ivy Conference. But that itself was a really challenging thing for us to cover, even just the ethics of it, right? You have photojournalists going around campus taking photos of this doxing truck. I felt ethically suspect to reproduce photos in our paper that would include this digital billboard with other students' faces and names on it.
Yeah, how do you cover the doxing truck without doxing students yourself?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But at the same time, right, like, there have been a lot of students requesting anonymity, and I've taken an approach this year of being very liberal about offering anonymity for stories about Israel's war against Hamas in any respect because of how prolific doxing has been on both sides of the issue, honestly. But sometimes I'm like, these also are people who are over the age of 18, and when other things happen that feel like they are more self-driven and less truck arrives on campus driven, what is the line for anonymity has been a very difficult thing for us to think about in our newsroom right now. Also because I think anonymity operates kind of differently here, where it's like a 6,000 student undergraduate population. And so everyone kind of knows everyone, and you put a name in the paper and everyone knows who it is. But I think to me, what's been the most challenging part of this whole thing was what you were talking about in that first question about we have relationships with these people. I mean, because we're an undergraduate paper, most of the people in our newsroom, honestly, everyone knows someone who thinks a very specific way or has a very specific take or a very strong take on the matter. And then you're running into social alienation and ostracization from various communities, right? I think some of our Jewish reporters have had a really, really hard time feeling like if they're covering the war in a way that perhaps some of their community members don't find very fair to Israel, they'll be more ostracized from Jewish events on campus. And that's been very difficult for them.
And is that even the case when they're writing something that's, I mean, just like full disclosure to the audience, like I went to Yale and worked for the YDN. And I feel like even back then, I graduated in 2017, there was a lot of explaining to students that just because you quote someone doesn't necessarily mean that you agree with what they're saying.
Neutrality, at least to me here, seems to be in the eye of the beholder. And everyone seems to want every quote to be challenged in very different ways. You know, I've heard from both sides of the issue, well, why would you let that quote go in the paper uncontested, let's say? Why are you allowing someone to talk about the harms unto the Israeli people on October 7th without also noting in the, you know, immediately subsequent graph what Israel is doing in Gaza? But if it's a story about, you know, Israeli students reacting to October 7th, that doesn't necessarily need to be the subsequent graph. It can be about student experiences. And we can have, as you're saying, another article that's reflecting on Palestinian and Arab students and their experiences right now. But they don't always need to be the same thing at the same place in the same time. I would actually find it more divisive if every article was, well, they say this and they say that and they say this and they say that. I would find that to be not offering space for anyone as opposed to space for everyone.
So clearly things have been pretty chaotic on campus ever since October 7th. And I do want to talk a little bit more later about anti-Semitism and xenophobia on campus and student safety. But first, I'm hoping that we can talk about the events directly leading up to the arrests on Monday.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll say that we had a sense that this was going to be coming last weekend. Organizers on campus were planning this very big week of demonstrations because the Yale Corporation was going to be meeting on Saturday, this past Saturday.
Do you mind explaining what the Yale Corporation is?
Yes. So the Yale Corporation is the university's highest governing body. It has 17 members. 16 of them are trustees, so various alumni, hedge fund managers, senior officials. And they're the ones who do things like choose the university's next president or make final calls on controversial things like divestment or investment choices. Yale has had an ongoing presidential search since the beginning of this academic year, since last fall, when our current president, Peter Salovey, announced that he would plan to step down from his role on June 30th. To date, there has been very little publicly disclosed, I guess, information from the corporation on what the requirements might be to satisfy this position or be eligible for it, on who they're considering for the job. And that's definitely been a source of faculty and student disdain on campus over the year. But at the end of last semester, when Elise Stefanik called other university presidents and not President Salovey to Congress to talk about campus anti-Semitism.
Following testimony at this week's congressional hearing about a lack of pushback against anti-Semitism on their campuses, Harvard's Claudine Gay, MIT's Sally Kornbluth, and Elizabeth McGill from the University of Pennsylvania answered questions posed by Republican Elise Stefanik.
It was pretty clear immediately that that might fundamentally change the way in which Yale approached its presidential search. We never got that from administrators, but it feels like a pretty intuitive jump that with, you know, presidents of selective universities now coming under national and international fire, that might make the corporation think a little bit about how a president might fare under those conditions when newly appointed. So with that kind of in mind, the corporation had its second to last meeting of the academic year this past Saturday. The next one's going to be early June. And in his initial announcement, President Salovey said that he would step down on June 30th. So the clock's kind of ticking here. So in the week leading up to this corporation meeting on Saturday, organizers who really favor Yale divesting from military weapons manufacturers, ostensibly pro-Palestine organizers in this current moment, set up like teach-ins, protests, songs, that kind of thing for the entire week. That kind of culminated in, well, began to culminate, I should say, in Friday's encampment, or as they called it, occupation of Beinecke Plaza, which is this pretty central part of campus. We have this big building called the Schwarzman Center that's like where the most popular, you know, not substantiated reported wise, but I would call it the most popular dining hall is. It's called Commons. There's like an underground coffee shop in this building. It's very well attended, right? And Beinecke Plaza is directly outside of it. So Friday evening, they're getting much more intense. It's a crowd of 400 people or something like that by, you know, 10:30 p.m. on Friday night. And it's honestly the biggest protest that I've seen in my 3 years at Yale. And it also, at least in the air, feels like it's the angriest.
How would you characterize the encampment? I mean, I feel like with students getting arrested at different universities, there's always this question of, are these peaceful protesters who are getting arrested for loitering, or is it are they getting arrested because of violence or violent rhetoric?
Well, then this is like a very personal perspective on it. It's not the newsroom's perspective. Mm-hmm. And I also have been present for a lot of the protesting, but not all of it. With those caveats in mind, I have not seen significant acts of violence transpire during these protests. They've been very peaceful. There have been a lot of counter-protesters. Students have come in and like entered this protest circle, at least on Friday, with like Israeli flags. But those disruptions, from what I've seen, have all been handled very peacefully. They've had marshals at all these protesters wearing like the neon green vests or whatever, who have like stood in between counter-protesters and protesters to try and minimize any kind of altercation, which has, I think, made them very peaceful in physicality. I do think the rhetoric has certainly felt very angry and vitriolic. Fuck you, Salve. I've heard intifada, intifada, down with Zionism, all walls will fall, things like that, that have not been physically violent, but I can certainly understand how they might elicit a very emotional response. The sentiment has certainly just like felt angry in the air, at least on Friday it did. And I was convinced that Friday night was going to be an arrest night. It seemed that way. I think protesters thought that too.
Arrested why? I mean, is it because they're not supposed to be in Beinecke Plaza late at night, or?
I should rewind a little bit maybe to clarify this one. On Monday was the first big day of this week of demonstrations preceding the corporation meeting. Student protesters had erected this wooden bookshelf, also on Beinecke Plaza, on the steps leading up to this big center on campus, the Schwarzman Center. And this was a source of a lot of administration student tension. Administrators are saying, oh, you can't put this up. You're blocking the entire stairwell. Organizers are like, there are two walkways on either side of the stairwell. Yes, we can put this up. And there's a lot of discourse on campus on Monday.
So this is the Monday before the encampments were erected. Okay.
And there's all this discourse on campus about like what university policy is, what are the consequences for violating university policy. And it's a little confusing because Beinecke Plaza, I suppose, has a closing time of 11 p.m. on weekends. It's different closing times on different days of the week. But students don't really go to bed at 11 p.m. and live on campus and are often on the plaza past 11 p.m. And there's this, I think, tension of, if I am a Yale student, why can't I use Yale property? Is, I think, the argument that people were kind of going at it with. But given, I think, this administration-student tension on Monday, I think it was unclear to what extent they would be enforcing those university policies on Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, could you walk through it to, like, get to where you were going? Or
you could totally walk through it. Even on Monday with the bookshelf, mm-hmm. You could totally walk through it. I do think part of the reason that perhaps some found it difficult to walk through it was
People are shouting things.
And also the beginning of that week had what's called Bulldog Days, where newly admitted Yale students come to campus for a couple of days.
To basically see if they want to go to the school.
And that also, I think, was a target of why all these organizers chose this week to do things. You have the corporation meeting upcoming where they're, you know, are going to talk about Yale's next president and perhaps could discuss divestment if they were so inclined, maybe. No one really knows what happens at these meetings because their minutes are sealed for 50 years after the date of the meeting, but perhaps they could. And you also have all these newly admitted students who are coming to Yale, and Yale, of course, wants to have students that are admitted matriculate to the university. But then you have this like kind of crazy scene on cross campus. The middle of the green is like people are sunbathing and all these like guys on some sports teams are playing spike ball in the middle of the green. But on the right by Sterling Memorial Library, which is the biggest library on campus, you have this table of mostly graduate students. It was a group of 14 students, two undergrads and 12 grad students who were on hunger strike. They began their hunger strike at some point in April. It was an 8-day long hunger strike that has recently concluded. They began their hunger strike to also urge Yale to divest from military weapons manufacturers. So they're on the right of campus. And then by day two of this big week of demonstrations, on the left of cross campus is this table entitled Let's Talk About Israel for students with, they say, a wide range of views on the Israeli state to discuss Israel's policies and the purpose of Israel and Israel's military response and all of those things. So it's honestly like the craziest scene of all time on cross campus where you have all these students just like kind of playing spike ball, but bookended by Israeli and Palestinian flags. And also there are like high school seniors walking around everywhere. And there's also like an inflatable bulldog kind of hanging out here too.
Oh my goodness.
It is truly an eclectic mix of things.
So what actually led to, like, the arrests on Monday?
Yeah, so administrators have told the paper that they had been trying really hard to avoid arrests and that they were in active negotiations with organizers of the protest. Organizers have confirmed that these were taking place, trying to offer various, like, concessions, we'll call them, or various compromises that might convince these student organizers to pack up and leave from their encampment on Beinecke Plaza. Among these included guaranteeing a meeting with two of the 16 trustees on the corporation, or guaranteeing meetings with people who sit on that committee that recommends investing policy to the corporation, a direct meeting with the dean of Yale College, Pericles Lewis, various deals like that. And they were spending, I think, most of the weekend trying to negotiate with these student organizers. And come Sunday night, they made their final deal. They gave until a certain time to accept that final deal. And what some students have said, and, you know, of course, they can't all be monolithic, but what some have said to us in response is that until Yale agrees to disclose its investments at a minimum, we're not interested in any kind of deal because Yale also only discloses less than 1% of where its endowment is invested and the other 99 point something remains unknown.
Wait. So that opens up a lot of questions. How do people even know to ask Yale to divest from weapons manufacturers if Yale isn't even really talking about the extent to which they do that?
Yeah, so the extent to which Yale does that remains incredibly unclear. It's certainly under 1% of the endowment that Yale has publicly disclosed. Of that under 1%, Yale has holdings in two exchange-traded funds, iShares and Vanguard. And iShares and Vanguard, respectively, have holdings in companies like Lockheed, Raytheon, Boeing. There's a whole slew of them. That translates to some amount of money that Yale then holds in those companies, which are weapons manufacturers. So I think the argument that organizers are making is that if even within this under 1% of disclosed endowment information, Yale already has holdings in weapons manufacturers, what else might they have? And so their demands, their chants kind of all week and all weekend have been like, Yale, disclose and divest. We will not stop. We will not rest, as they say, like until Yale discloses and divests. And so when admin kind of came forward trying to make all these negotiation deals, at least some students were like, until Yale discloses its investments in totality, we are uninterested in any kind of deal. And so at a certain point, I guess, on Sunday night, administration was like, look, this is your final warning. Unless you leave, we are going to arrest you. We're going to have Yale police arrest you. And then you know what happened. They didn't leave. And another warning came out on Monday morning before 7 a.m. And then, you know, they started getting arrested.
So, I mean, they were arrested, but it sounds like they weren't necessarily held. What were the students charged with specifically?
Yeah, so it's a Class A misdemeanor for trespassing. They all have summons for May 8th under Yale policy. And they said this a bunch of times over the weekend before arrests yesterday. Disciplinary action from the university could include suspension. It could include reprimand, probation, and could, some seniors worry, potentially preclude them from graduating. We're not totally sure if that'll happen given the timeline of all the things, but it definitely is a worry for some of the seniors involved.
So, Anika, I'd like to ask you more about just like the atmosphere on campus. But first, we're going to take a quick break. So you'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
I guess I'm still stuck on this idea that the protests themselves, like the end goal, is a little bit speculative, and that we actually don't really know how much Yale is investing in weapons manufacturers. We just know that to some extent they are investing at least a bit. I guess I'm wondering if like we should, you know, actually see these protests as just like more of like a larger solidarity thing, since like even if Yale were to agree to completely divest from weapons manufacturers, that wouldn't necessarily result in like a ceasefire or something. But I guess I'm just trying to figure out how like what the level of like efficacy here, and whether it's more of like a show of support or whether the students actually expect Yale to do something here.
Yeah. I don't think that they're thinking that if Yale commits to divestment, there's going to be a ceasefire. To me, this resembles protests from like 2018-ish when Yale and Harvard students were rallying to get their schools to divest from fossil fuels. At that time, too, it was true that we didn't really know the full extent of Yale's investments in fossil fuels. But Yale operates by this handbook called like the Ethical Investor Handbook. And then adapt regulations based on that, in which they stipulate what holdings are off limits, right? That now includes fossil fuels, right? That recently has grown to include Yale does not invest in assault weapons retailers that market to the general public. That was an update that came like last week. I think that they're looking for two things. One, disclosure of what Yale's holdings are overall, that full 100% of investments. And then two, a commitment that Yale will bar holdings in military weapons manufacturers, just as they have without disclosure for assault weapons retailers that market to the general public. I actually don't know which of those two is more feasible, but it seems like there are like two goals in the mix here.
So you mentioned earlier that there have been divisions on the Yale campus and on campuses nationwide since October 7th. You know, obviously this is the only protest so far related to Israel and Gaza that has resulted in arrests, as far as I know of, on the Yale campus. But what have the other demonstrations been like?
I never thought that protests earlier in the year had risen to a level that could even come close to warranting arrest. At the same time, I think this campus is currently, and has been since October 7th, the most divisive that I've seen it in 3 years, which is interesting because we've had pretty sweeping political things happen in the past 3 years with like abortion rights and affirmative action as two pretty notable examples of that. But it's never been, I think, this visibly polarized.
Is that divisiveness because of just like the way in which students are responding to the divisive things that are happening nationally and internationally and kind of disagreeing with each other like on like intellectual grounds? Or is it because of things that are actually happening on campus that are basically pitting students against each other?
I think it's probably a mix of both. I think this is a deeply emotional issue for so many people. I mean, and of course, like abortion rights and affirmative action are too, but this is one where people pretty conceivably have family members that are being killed, you know, in abroad, or maybe were in Israel for, you know, summer break or something like that, visiting family. That's obviously an incredibly difficult experience. Or have family in Gaza who have been killed by the Israeli military response.
Are you seeing a lot of students like that? Because I feel like one way in which, you know, like campus protests are often characterized or mischaracterized by the media is like, look at all of these, you know, like rich college students from Greenwich who, you know, go to Yale and are protesting about something that they don't know anything about and have no actual connection to.
I think that a lot of the people who have expressed a very pro-Israel or anti-divestment, that general part of the spectrum of thoughts, have spoken with the news or written opinion pieces or spoken at vigils and prayers about friends and family who are either in the IDF and fighting the war or who were killed on October 7th or in the aftermath of it. So I've certainly seen and heard a lot of that. I've heard less people describe family in Gaza on camps, but I think that's also possibly because of general concerns about doxing or things like that. So I'm not trying to draw an equivalency between those two at all. That's just what I've seen and observed in terms of who's being vocal about family experiences in the region right now. I don't think that I would characterize at least the most divisive parts of these protests as people who don't care or don't have a legitimate emotional connection to it. I think people really, really do. I will say that I think part of yesterday's mass demonstration blocking that intersection was certainly people who favor divestment, but also people who were responding to Yale police having arrested friends and peers, who might not have like really cared about the divestment cause at all prior, or maybe very minimally prior, or even had the opposite take prior, but were just upset about or wanting to support, you know, their friends who had been arrested.
What has the university's response been to all of the divisiveness on campus this year?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's been a lot of it. I'll talk about maybe, I guess, like three specific events that I remember. The first was pretty in the early days of all of this. A student wrote the words "Death to Palestine" on a whiteboard in one of the residential colleges here. At least two students complained about that having been written to administration. In response, the head of that residential college sent an email to all that college's students, not describing the incident itself, but like pretty clearly alluding to it, right? I mean, the timing is not coincidental. Describing Yale's commitment to like protected political speech and like academic free speech and all that kind of stuff, which was interesting. They really haven't also cracked down on phrases that, as we saw in the press in November and December nationally, have been deemed anti-Semitic by many, such as Intifada and things like that. There really haven't been crackdowns on that sort of stuff either. What I would say was the most interesting administrative response to me last semester was students put up this banner also near the Beinecke Plaza, Schwarzman area. Maybe you're seeing how important this area is on campus now.
Yeah.
But put up this banner that had enumerated a bunch of names of Palestinians that Israel had killed in Gaza. Like, I think at this point it was maybe some tens of thousands of names they have written on this thing. And a student later went to administration asking if he could take the banner down. The administrator allowed it to be taken down. And that was also a source of a lot of dissent and controversy on campus about, like, why could they put that up in the first place? And from, you know, one camp saying that and the other camp saying like, well, why could he take it down also? And then later admin comes back, or the administrator involved comes back and says like, there were administrative errors, she writes, in allowing the banner to both be put up and taken down. There has been a lot more communication in the past like 5 days about protest and free speech on campus than I think the entirety of this semester and maybe even the entirety of last semester, but I haven't checked that exactly. The last time that we got a university-wide email even related to the war that came from the university president, Peter Salove, was December 7th. It was called Against Hatred and kind of listed all these things about like, you know, be kind to your peers and Yale is committed to free speech, but also to like protecting each other, and we don't tolerate harassment of any kind, whether it's to Jewish students, Muslim students, Arab students, Israeli students. And now in the past like 3 days since the encampment began, we've gotten two emails from President Salove. We've got an email from administration in the past week about like Yale's policy on chalking, like drawing things in chalk on sidewalks and on university buildings, putting up structures, I think in direct reference to the bookshelf that was erected last Monday. And things like that have certainly become a lot more prevalent in our inboxes in the past week than they were before.
We'll have more with the editor-in-chief of the Yale Daily News after the break. If you have thoughts or questions about today's episode, send us an email or voice memo to themail@newyorker.com. Be sure to put the political scene in the subject line.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
You know, you mentioned earlier that in December, the presidents of Harvard, UPenn, and MIT were called before Congress to talk about anti-Semitism on their campuses, and two of them have since resigned. And it kind of seems like Salovey has, like, flown under the radar a little bit, and I'm curious whether it's because he's on his way out. I guess I'm just curious why he hasn't really faced the same scrutiny, and then also what his views seem to be based on what he's communicated to the Yale community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think his communications that have been public to the Yale community have been pretty standard in that, you know, Yale prioritizes and values free expression, but also puts student safety above all else, that kind of thing. We don't tolerate harassment, discrimination. We are investigating all reports of violence and threatening and intimidation. I think part of why President Salovey has flown under the radar is perhaps because he just said fewer things. I do concurrently think that there is a larger national political capital argument to be made here that, like, President Salovey is on his way out, as you were saying. I don't think Rep. Stefanik would have gained as much clout for grilling President Salovey as she did for grilling President Gay for a whole litany of reasons.
I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about, just like from the reporting the YDN has done, what anti-Semitism on campus has looked like. You know, there have been reports that there was a Jewish student who was poked in the eye with a flagpole at the encampments and needed to be treated at the hospital. And you mentioned, you know, people chanting Intifada and also protesters chanting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And I'm just curious what anti-Semitism has looked like. Yeah, the extent to which it's been an issue for student safety.
Yeah. Again, like I was saying before, I haven't myself seen things that have appeared violent at the protests that I've been at for the times at which I've been there. We have reached out to, like, Yale police and New Haven police to try and see, like, if there were assaults reported and try and verify what happened, because we just don't know exactly what happened. So that certainly is in the works journalistically for us right now. What it's looked like on campus is, I think, a bit of a challenging question, right? In that, how do we define any kind of bigotry to begin with? Is it a feeling? Is it an act? Is it a thing that we can demarcate clearly? These things constitute, you know, anti-Semitism or racism or classism, or is it more like, oh, like, this feels classist or anti-Semitic to me, right? At least things that I've observed that have seemed incredibly difficult to me, right, are, like, Jewish students on campus feeling obliged to now have a perspective on Israel when perhaps they didn't have that before or feel the need to have that before. It's like a what is your take game, which camp do you fall in game? Is it good? Is it bad? Do we deserve it? Do we not? I think are questions that I've watched a lot of my Jewish friends work through over the last year, and I can totally see how the general environment on campus would feel, like, difficult, right, to work through those questions in perhaps a disproportionate way for Jewish students, right? There also have been a lot of concerns about student safety from Arab and Palestinian students on campus, especially in light of the shooting that happened elsewhere in the Northeast of three Palestinian and Arab students. There have been a lot of concerns here about, like, students not wanting to go on the record with the YDN, who are Arab or Muslim, who are worried about being doxxed or worried about being attacked in that kind of way. Because it is also true that the doxing truck had mostly people of color on it, and that's felt racialized to a lot of people. I'm not really sure exactly how to define, I don't think anyone is sure how to define all these various structures of marginalization, but I think everyone here is feeling a different way in different levels about ways that they're being cast out or pushed aside right now.
On Monday afternoon, there was like a big faculty walkout at Columbia where hundreds of members turned up in solidarity with the students. And I'm wondering what the faculty response has been like at Yale.
A bunch of professors canceled class yesterday or made it optional. Yale has 14 residential colleges, and a number of the heads of those colleges have sent emails out to their students saying, you know, I'm sending love, I'm sending hugs, I'm sending support to you all. And a lot of those heads have also been present for some of the protesting, not necessarily to participate, but just to see what's happening and show up a little bit. I haven't heard myself of faculty members like not offering extensions or general empathy or support just for the entire like divisive and very, very challenging situation on campus right now. Like even if you weren't involved in the protests or were nowhere near across campus yesterday or Beinecke yesterday, I think it is incredibly difficult, right, to like read a headline and like a national paper or like an international paper that's like, you know, more than 40 students arrested at Yale is a hard thing, even if you aren't involved or anywhere proximal to those who were arrested.
Yeah, like a couple of weeks before finals period.
Yeah.
I guess I'm curious what you think national media organizations are missing when it comes to the story of student demonstrations and protests on campus. What do you think that we should be paying more attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing, at least for Yale specifically, is I've seen a lot of attention on these protests being super violent and horrific and all of those things. And like, I haven't been at all of it. I have been at a lot of it. I think characterizing them as wholesale violent feels somewhat inaccurate. They've been largely peaceful. And I think there's a component of motivation that I think I haven't really seen in a lot of national stories, right? Like I've seen like, they're getting arrested and they have class and they're busy and these are students who are doing a lot of things. But I haven't really seen a lot of like, why are students doing this? And it speaks to what you were saying before too, right? Like, are these just people who are wealthy and go to Ivy League schools who just want to do something to virtue signal? Or are these students who have this deep emotional connection to something, right? And I feel like I would super, super consume articles that were thinking about like a cross university perspective on why students across are doing this. Is there communication across the Columbia and the MIT and the Yale and the Maryland protesters? And Berkeley announced one too yesterday. Stuff like that feels really interesting to me. I would love to see more like motivation related stories as to why they're doing this and what their incentives are here.
Well, thank you so much, Anika.
Thanks, Tyler.
Anika Arora-Seth is the editor-in-chief and president of the Yale Daily News. You can follow the paper's ongoing coverage of the campus protests at yaledailynews.com. Thanks to Nydia Del Carmen at the Yale Daily News for providing the audio that we played from Friday's protests. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Stephanie Karayuki, with production assistance from Jake Loomis and Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
From PR.